Welcome to the Waffle Shop podcast with me, Taylor James. This is the podcast that gets people waffling about their mental health, coping mechanisms, life's minor inconveniences, and the music that soundtracks it all. So join me as I open up shop and have a waffle.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Welcome to the Waffle Shop podcast. Today, I'm joined by someone who, quite frankly, I've been wanting to speak to or waffle with for a very, very long time. I think we were one of the first people we connected with when the Waffle Shop started. It's the brilliant founder of Edge of the Bed and Prevention Pathways, Ryan Gadsby.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Welcome to the Waffle Shop.
Yeah, I've been watching for a while, so it's good to finally
been a long time coming.
Yeah, definitely.
Long time.
Yeah. So yeah, it's exciting to come on. I haven't done a podcast like this for over a year, so it's good to come on.
Oh, no pressure then.
Yeah, fresh mindset and everything like that. So yeah, it's exciting to be here.
That's good. No, it genuinely is a pleasure, especially like in person as well.
Yeah.
It's kind of quite overwhelming to go from, which I've read, there's part of this that we'll kind of dive into with like with your own story, but putting yourself out there on any kind of level. So to go from like recording in my bedroom to now being sat in like a studio with people that genuinely inspire me to like, it's weird.
Yeah,
I don't think it will ever not be weird.
Yeah, definitely. I remember I did the same thing. So I had my own podcast, The Edge of Bed Podcast. And I went from in my bedroom on the Skype call or whatever it was, recording it there, to then being in a studio with people. The switch is completely different, but it's a nice switch as well because you really get to feel like you're connecting with that person, you're getting to know them. And
definitely.
Yeah, so yeah, it's interesting, but...
We'll get there. So I usually start the podcast with something called the Weekly Waffle, which is something has kind of like, it's pissed me off, to be frank. And then once I've spoken about it to my guests, it makes me feel a little bit better. However, this episode is quite a new kind of topic for me. And I've kind of watched from afar with how much strength that you've shown, like sharing your story, how you've kind of supported so many more people. So I kind of want to bypass the Weekly Waffle, if
that's okay.
That's
fine.
Because I feel like it's quite negative and I want this to kind of be like an inspiring conversation, which I mean, it will no doubt be anyway.
Yeah. I'm glad that you said that, to be honest, because, you know, when you are a survivor and you're sharing your story openly, and I connect with a lot of other people that do the same thing as me, you'll go on a podcast or you'll do an interview type thing and people treat you as a victim, or they'll speak of it in such a, right, today we're talking about abuse or something like that. And it just brings the tone really low down at the start. And I think sometimes there needs to be that little bit of like positivity within it and hope within it. And that's what I try to bring even with the reels and the content I post. It's about the rising up and you know, making something of your story rather than thinking about the initial depth of, I guess, your despair or whatever, you know.
No, so. To be fair, and I think it's one of the reasons why I kind of relate to your content. Obviously, I haven't been through what you have been through. However, you're this kind of like ray of light in this kind of stuff that, from just a mental health point of view, there's so many podcasts out there that's like mental health. People go on, they'll share their stories, which is phenomenal, like so much respect. But then it's almost like you sit in that pocket of kind of like the bad, whereas, you know, with the bad, there is also good. There is good days. There are funny moments. There's great moments.
Yeah, of course.
And it's that I kind of really tap into when it comes to like your content and like parts of your story. Because we don't have to stay in that kind of pocket.
Exactly. Sometimes I will share bits of my story, like little pockets of it, like you're saying. I think it is important to do that because people can relate to that and it might make them comfortable with accepting their own story. And that is also an important part. But again, with the healing side, you are encouraging, I guess, moving forward. I don't like the term moving on, but moving forward is what I like to say. Because with an experience like mine, which I'll explain, I feel like we're gatekeeping information here. But I think like... with a story like mine, it is kind of like, it's going to be with you for the rest of your life, something like an experience like that. But you need to keep pushing and keep going. It can't be something that holds you back from living your life to the full extent that you can.
Mate, it's inspiring already. Genuinely, like,
I appreciate
it.
It
was worth the wait just for the start.
Yes.
For anyone who isn't familiar with yourself or the page or what you stand for, I'd quite like to talk about the story, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And obviously time, feel free to share whatever you feel comfortable. Yeah. I mean, I know you're an open book now.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And with this, to be fair, like, I'm going to ask your advice with this because I don't know how to approach. Obviously, it's very new territory for me with this kind of conversation. Would you at this point kind of give like a trigger warning or, do you know, like...
Yeah.
Because obviously it's a very, very sensitive topic.
Yeah, of course. I think we should always give a trigger warning. I mean, I do in if my reels are particularly, so like Instagram reels or TikToks or whatever, if they're particularly in depth about experiences that I've had, I will put a trigger warning in front of it. Because again, some people aren't as comfortable with their story, like, and to see something like that can trigger a mental health episode or something like that. So yeah, I always give a trigger warning. You know, topics such as sexual abuse, physical abuse, and emotional abuse will come up. Wow. Yeah, that sort of thing.
To be fair, I'm going to leave that in there.
Yeah,
because I can explain that far better than what I could have.
Yeah.
So massive respect for that. I mean, I don't even know where to begin. Like,
yeah, no, I mean, I can go from the start. So I always start my story. I don't go right back and just like, I was born in DRI in Doncaster Royal, you know, anything like that.
Is that where you were born?
That wasn't where I was born, just in case anyone was interested. So no, I don't go right back to that. But what I would start is, me and my mum and my sister all lived together in a council estate in a quite deprived area of Doncaster called Highfields, which we've recently moved back to, which has been thrilling. So yeah, we grew up there, and obviously my mum at the time didn't have a lot of money and my dad had just left, and we ended up homeless and we lived at my nan's, and we started to go to a local church. I think my mum went, not for religious purposes. I don't think she's ever been particularly religious. I think she went for the community side and like just having people around she could talk to. But yeah, I think she found that quite helpful at the time. But at the church we met, who went on to become my stepdad, he was called Andrew. And I can say all this now for reasons I can explain later. But yeah, so we met him there, and then him and my mum got chatting. And my first memory of him is he offered me biscuits at the church. That's the first time I remember meeting him. And then...
how old were you?
Like, so at this time, I would have been...
remember that kind of specific moment?
Yeah, yeah. So I was probably just about to turn eight, wow, around that age. Yeah. And then their relationship progressed quite quickly. So they went on a first date like 2 weeks after that. And he asked if me and my sister could go with them to the first date. Which I thought, okay, when I reflect on that, I'm kind of like, you know, that's a bit of a red flag there for me personally. But my mum, I think she was a bit, I don't think she could think clearly at that time in her life. So we all went on this first date to KFC, you know, classy date. So we went to KFC and then, yeah, it progressed really, really quickly after that. They were married within a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and we moved in within 7 months. Obviously, we didn't have a house. We was living with my nan in my nan's back room around the time. So, yeah, we moved in, and he quickly became the main authority figure in mine and my sister's life. I don't know how he did it, but he had a way of just establishing power over my mum really, really early on.
So it's always like you were in his house, like the dominant.
Exactly, that. And he used that phrase quite a lot, like you're under my roof now type thing. Right. And he used that to his, to his power, I guess, to get that control over me and my sister. And I think at the start, it started off with him sort of like, my mum would go to him and say, so I'd go to my mum and say, oh, can I play out tonight? And she'd go, oh, I'll go and ask. And we quickly called him dad.
Yeah.
So she'd be like, I'll go and ask your dad. So, that's
but
how
you were also at an age where if like your dad, like biologically had kind of left, a figure has come in. It's quite a, I guess, like a quick process.
It is. Yeah. And
I haven't been through it, but I imagine.
Yeah, I would agree. It is a quick process. And especially for me, I always wanted a dad figure in my life. Yeah. And I saw my friends with their dads, and it was something where I was like, I really want that. So I quickly, I was called the spoiled child, which reflecting back now is quite like a painful thing. So I was known as like the spoiled kid because of how close we seemed.
Right.
But overcasting that obviously was the sexual abuse. First time it ever happened, I used to be really scared of water. It was like my biggest fear. I couldn't swim and I was terrified of water. So he said to my mum, I'll go and help him in the shower. So because I used to scream the house down. It's like one of them stories that my family tell me all the time, like whenever you used to get a bath, you scream the house down, they could hear you down the street and all that. So we were like, I'll help in the shower. And then I obviously was excited for it because he was like my new dad type thing at the time. It was still very new. So I was like, oh yeah. And then that was the first time it happened. And then the sexual abuse sort of continued from 8 until, it's hard to remember, but I think it was around 12, 13. Around that time, it started to fade out. And I think what it came from was obviously his attraction is to children. And I wasn't a child anymore.
You were a teenager.
Yeah, exactly. So at that point, it began to fade out. And over time, it was kind of it sounds hard, but it was kind of nice for a bit. There was nothing. And it was it was a proper family, was getting along, was going on nice holidays, which is something we'd never experienced. We was going to Spain and things that seemed quite normal to people. We was really blown away by.
Was this just directed towards you? Obviously, was your sister younger than you?
My sister's older than me by a year, but she's never experienced any sexual.
Right. So it was literally
just me, yeah.
Right.
And so, yeah, for them few years, it was, I say probably a year, I would say, a year and a bit. It was kind of calm and there wasn't anything that happened. And then after that, he started to become more controlling over me. And it was kind of little things. So I found out that he had a tracker in my phone and I had no idea it was in there. And the way that I found out is, as a teenager, obviously you lie about where you're going when you go out. So I was like, oh, I'm just heading to this closer park. But me and my friends went down to another park. And then I was walking back up and he just knew where I was. And he pulled up in his car and grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and just dragged me into the car. And I was like, how did he know I was there? And so I looked into it more. And then the phone that he'd bought me off eBay was this dodgy brand. I can't remember the name of it. And from the mother phone, you could track the other mobile and see everything that phone's doing. So you could see
so
everything
calculated.
That I did on my phone. Yeah. And then later on,
with you being the age that you are, obviously you're going to grow up and you start getting more inquisitive. Obviously the world is changing. Obviously your body is changing. Everything is changing at those kind of ages. So naturally there's going to be a lot more questions.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. And later on we come to find out in the police investigation that I had a hidden camera in my bedroom in the corner. But I knew in my teenage years that he was watching me through my webcam. He had a thing called TeamViewer, which is where other computers on your network, you can see what they're doing on their computer screen. And he would click on the camera feature and he would look through my webcam.
I used to work for an IT company.
Yeah.
And we used to use that if you used to remote onto like our clients.
Yeah, computers. So we'd use TeamViewer, click on my camera for my webcam, and I'd see the light pop up. And I remember the first time it happened, I laid in bed and I thought I'd been hacked or something like that. And I was like, what the hell? So I remember crawling under and then like just switching my PC off, because I used to just leave it on. And then one night I went to go and catch him. And I like saw that the webcam came on. I jumped up out of bed, ran downstairs to where he would sit in the living room. And I could see on his mobile phone, he could see my desktop and my room on his phone. So
in this period of time, like, apologies if I'm asking too many questions.
No, honestly, like I said at the start, you can ask me anything.
Was there an element, like, because you see this type of thing, like in TV shows and stuff like that, to so many different degrees, like from like a mental side of thing, like it's almost... Were you trying to convince yourself that it was happening, but that it wasn't happening? Like, it was that kind of, I don't know how to kind of articulate
I know what you're asking. Yeah, it was kind of like, it felt surreal to me. And it was like, so is this really happening? Is it in my head? Because he would manipulate and gaslight to make me think when I would, because I would accuse him of things in this period of time. As I said, it predominantly started, like progressively, started to get controlling and more aggressive with this. But in this period of time, I would confront him about things like, have you been watching me? And he'd be like, what are you talking about? How dare you accuse me of that type thing. And just going into his character a bit more, he was kind of like well-liked, like he was a big part of the community. He'd raise money for charity a lot.
Right.
He would. He was a reader at the church, which is like kind of the step down from the
narcissistic
vicar.
Narcissistic.
Yeah, and he kind of used that as his wall to like hide what he was really about. And, you know, in these conversations where I'd accuse me of things, he'd be like, I'm a man of the church. I'm a religious man. Do you really think I would do something like that? And beside this, I never mentioned the sexual abuse. I never confronted that. That was something that was pushed back from my side as well as kind of his at that point. Until a point late in my later teen age, about 15 years old, I said to him, I know what you did to me when I was young was wrong, and I know that happened.
Wow. What spurred that moment?
It was this increase in control. The increase in control and just like mental abuse was, it was like too much. So I just thought, you know, I'm just going to tell him what I think. And like, it was kind of an attempt from me to regain power, I think.
Yeah.
And I was kind of just like, I'm sick of like not being able to do what I want to do, because along with, you know, the mobile phone and the cameras, it was also like I had to be in at like 5 o'clock when I was like 15. It's like, it seems so little, but it's like, it was like so stupid. And our bedtime was like 9:30.
Yeah.
It's like I'm 15, all my friends are like taking the mess out of it. But the thing is,
and you can kind of relate this to like the whole pandemic thing, we're not meant to be caged.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's a very human thing to want to kind of explore, be out at certain times, like all these stuff that like, the normal things from a childhood were almost being taken away from you.
No, exactly. And like, obviously I had a lot of friends at school and they were all going out and doing things and like asking me, oh, do you want to come to this party? Do you want to do this? And I was just like, I can't. And like, if I ever dared to do that, he just knew. He knew that I'd done it because of the phone and the videos. In the moment where I confronted him, that's the first time he ever became violent.
Wow.
Yeah, so... obviously said I know what he did to me was wrong, and then I broke down crying, and I remember I fell to his knees and I was like, all I ever wanted you to be is my dad. Like, I didn't want any of this. I wanted you to be the dad that, you know, other people had. And then I remember he punched me in the face for the first time then, and he like knocked me back, and then he was like this whole spouting thing again with the, how dare you accuse me of that when I'm a man of the church and all this lot, and like everything I've done for your family, you were homeless and all this sort of stuff. And then from that point on, it was kind of like the physical abuse would come at a time whenever I stuck up for myself about the sexual abuse. It was like a attempt to keep me quiet.
I feel like my blood is boiling.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so grateful that you're in a position now to kind of like be sharing this. Mm. Like, and I'm genuinely like, I was inspired in the first like 2-3 minutes, but now I'm just like, I've only met you for the first time today, but I'm so fucking proud of doing what you're doing. It is phenomenal. I know it obviously can't be easy revisiting this, but like when the violence kind of like started, was there another turning point to be like, right, enough is enough now? Like, I can't, like, did you tell your friends, like did like the family members?
So he managed to keep all of this like under wraps. No one else in the family ever knew about the sexual abuse, the emotional abuse or physical abuse. It's very under wraps. And I, as much as him, didn't want anyone to find out about the sexual abuse because I was so ashamed. And if anything, I helped him keep the secret for a long time. For me, between mine and his relationship, it was very, it's a hard one to like explain to someone who hasn't been through it, like interfamiliar abuse is what I'd describe it as, like abuse within the family or home. Because you still love them, that person as your dad, despite what's happened. I mean, from like 7, 8 years old, he brought me up, he taught me things, taught me to swim, taught me to, you know, do all these different things, took me on these holidays, and you still have these memories. And it's kind of as though, and I know that a lot of survivors describe it as this way, you sort of live in this split life, like you kind of subcategorize the abuse with day-to-day experiences within the family. That's how it worked in my head, a sort of dissociation type thing. And it was the only way I could survive with living with him and also all that happening. And so, like, I always felt a guilt, even when the physical abuse was happening, about ever confronting him properly or ever doing something about it, because I didn't want him to get into trouble or him to face any repercussions or to lose him. Which sounds so strange, like I said, for you guys, for anyone who hasn't experienced it. But it is still true, you still have that bond with the person. And that is the hardest barrier that I had to get over, I felt. Yeah. Was kind of like dropping that and saying, like realising that, you know, he never loved me, he never did those things for good reasons. It was all to hide that secret.
It's easy from the outside looking in to have that opinion.
Yeah.
But you're also, you can't help how you feel.
Yeah,
they're your emotions to feel. Mm-hmm. So if you do have a little bit of happiness in those kind of moments, I don't think, regardless of what happened, I don't think anyone could tell you that's the wrong thing to feel.
No, exactly.
So in that moment, that's what you were feeling.
I mean, I posted a reel, I think about a week ago now, and I told the story from the perspective of my dad. Well, we're going to come on to it, but my dad committed suicide. That's the first thing I put. And then I went on to tell the story, and halfway through I said, but he also sexually and physically abused me. Yeah. And I think that was a good way to put it across to people, to get them to feel the emotion of like, because at the start, all the viewers on the video were like, oh, really, like feeling the grief for me, kind of like, and relating to me in that way. Then halfway through, they're like, whoa, mm-hmm. and kind of like shocked, the shock factor of it. But that's so true for many survivors that I speak to, that like you do have that grief period along with dealing with the emotions of what actually happened and the abuse and things like that. So it's a really complex thing to navigate, even still for myself now, which I would say I'm in a good place in terms of my own like healing. It's still a hard, hard place to navigate for everyone, for all survivors.
You've got such a phenomenal head on your shoulders.
Thank you.
I do not think there's a lot of people who could sit in your position and kind of articulate the way that you are right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I appreciate
like, I'm genuinely
that, yeah.
like in a little bit of awe.
The way that I got out of the abuse, I would say, I was 16, so that was 2017, I believe. And I was extremely, with like the complex emotions I was describing, I felt very stuck. And I was like, how do I get out of this? Like, it just felt like there was no way. Every single door that I'd thought about in my head, there was no way. So I'd like planned to take my own life. And I remember the day before I was going to take my own life, it was such a strange like evening, and I began to write like suicide letters for my mum and my sister and my nan. And so I started writing them all. And then I hid them in the top drawer of my desk. And then the day after when it came, I was supposed to be going to work. So I went into the bathroom for a shower, and I was going to like kill myself in the shower, basically, not to go into it, but then at the last minute, sort of something happened, and kind of like something switched in my head, like, no, I need to like fight. I need to fight for this. Like, I need to like take control of this and get back. And not, the thing for me is I wanted to regain that power like I did the years before, but in a way that would actually fix things in a way. And like I said, the main thing pushing back on me was the guilt and the feeling of like, shame about the sexual abuse, but also about hurting him and getting him in a position that would like cause him pain despite everything. So I decided to yeah, go to the police. So
before we dive into the whole police thing, I want to kind of ask you a question about what you've just said. Is to say it out loud is an incredibly powerful thing to do. How do you feel now kind of telling that part of your, because it's a massive turning point to be at that, almost like that rock bottom, and just having that kind of, it's, I guess, that fire that's lit in that kind of like moment. How do you feel now telling that story compared to where you were?
Yeah, it's one of the moments that like I remember so like clearly in my mind, because it was like the big turning point. Like I might not be here now if it wasn't for my mindset that day. And it was so strange because I'd planned it and thought about it for so long. And then in that split second, it's like something just switched in my head, and it was like it's kind of saving. And like I was looking at myself in the mirror and I was kind of like, I can't let it beat me. I just can't let it. I can't let him do that as well. So yeah, when I reflect on it, it's one of them things where I'm grateful for my younger self for like pushing through that and getting to that point. So yeah, it's something that I always remember and think about. Even tough times now, I reflect back to that moment and I'm like, you know what? No, Ryan, we're not giving into it. We're not letting him win. I'm going to push through this, even if it's a hard patch, which of course everyone has it. And even especially with our stories, everyone has those moments where it's a hard patch. And now I'm just like, think back to that moment. We got through that. Let's just push through. Or it's for nothing, isn't it? I did that for nothing, so.
Talk to me about like the next step then. Obviously, you're in a position now where you're like, right, I need to do something. Like, I've got that power. You went to the police. Did you go alone, or how did that scenario look?
So I navigated it with a friend, sort of how I was going to do it. But the day that I was supposed to be, I was supposed to be going to work. So conveniently, the McDonald's I worked at was next door to a police station. So I just told him I was going to work and he dropped me off at work. The last thing I ever said to him was, I'm not going to keep your secret anymore. That was the last thing I ever said to him. And then he tried to grab my arm and tried to pull me back in the car, but I just pushed out, shut door, and then I could just see him like going like this back to the car as I walked away. And then I went into the McDonald's and hid in the toilet and just cried in there, like just bawled my eyes out on the floor, still contemplating what I was going to do. And then I walked around to the police station and I went in, and initially they told me I might have to come back tomorrow. Which I was like, if I was to go home that night, I'm pretty convinced that I would have been like murdered. Like, I would have been killed. It's just some of the things that I did in those years of physical violence. Like the scariest moment, he knocked me out completely in the office again. And I woke up and he was holding a knife just here. And he said, I could fucking kill you like this right now and that'd be it. And like, knowing what he was capable of and what he, like moments like that, that I can remember, I said to this police officer, like, if I go home, I am literally going to get murdered. I need to speak to you today. And he was like, all right, then. And it was like so poorly dealt with. But anyway, these two lovely officers came and spoke to me. And then they took me to what's called the Mary Willett Centre, which is like a specialist like facility for that type of thing in Doncaster. And then I did a 4-hour interview telling basically my whole life story in extreme detail. And then the investigation started. He was arrested that night. And I remember the moment the police officer said to me, he said, we're going to arrest him now. And it was like such a like feeling of like, oh, it's actually done. Like it's actually over. And yeah, it was a strange time.
How in that moment, like, was it like a relief? Was it like a, because obviously you've kind of touched upon a word that is, I find quite fascinating, especially for someone who's been through what you've been through. It was like the guilt. Like what were the emotions that you were feeling once they said, we're going to arrest him?
The guilt side is kind of goes back to the memories of when you are a child and that like father relationship that I had with him.
Yeah.
So I think the guilt with that is kind of like, you feel like it's your fault that it's happening to them, someone that you think that you love, someone that you think's like your family. So I think the guilt side was predominantly that. And I remember when I was crying, I was like saying sorry to him, to myself, but to him. And like, obviously understanding now as I've gone through my healing journey, like I still get days where it's kind of like, I reflect back on the memories as a child and it's kind of the complex emotions, but I don't feel guilt to a way that about him. I understand now that what he was doing was completely wrong. But you've got to think like, that was my life. Like I had no other influence of what was normal or what. So it's been kind of like a journey from 16 when I got out to now kind of like seeing how you're meant to, how relationships are meant to be, or healthy, how healthy relationships are meant to be. So yeah, that's the only way I can describe it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So what happened after? Sorry, I feel like I'm like...
No, honestly, keep asking.
And then what happened? But no, it's generally like the way you're carrying yourself, like, I'm generally is mind-blowing. In a good way, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
So they arrested him. Like, we obviously, you were kept separate.
Yeah, from him. He was told that he couldn't contact like me, my mum, or my sister, or anyone in the family. So after that, I sort of went into a bit of like a depressive sort of spiral, like I'd describe it as. So I lived in my uncle's back room, and then we managed to get a little terrace house with my mum and my sister. And it was the first time that I'd lived with them, like with them since everything, like since being together as a family. That really hit me, that. And I, like, subconsciously, I didn't realise at the time, but when I do reflect back, like, it really hit me. So I started to, like, I quit college, I quit my job, and I just sat in all day. And there's some photos on my Instagram of me at this time. And I began to just starve myself, so I didn't eat at all. I ended up in the hospital for it. Like, my body was eating its own fat store, so I had, like, ketones, like, in my blood and things like that. So, yeah, it was, like, a really, really, like, hard time. And then, obviously, with the police coming around all the time, it felt as though, like, people were turning on me in the community. So the church that we went to, it's a very, very, I'm not going to give the name because I can't, but it's a very strange place. Like, there's multiple convicted paedophiles that go to the church.
What?
And are allowed in the church. And it, like, it still to this day angers me. And it's so funny because we were a member of the church and they knew what he did. They stayed in contact with him, but didn't offer any support to me, my mum, and my sister at the time, even though we never went back. It was still like, we've
But
we've
if you look
there.
Back at the reasons why your mum and, like, you as a family went there in the first place, was the sense of community. It was that sense of, like, being a part of something bigger.
Yeah.
So to now have, again, a huge part of life as you knew it, almost kind of, again, taken away.
Yeah.
Like, regardless of the age, I think that is going to hit you like a ton of bricks.
Exactly, yeah. And so there's no, like, support offered from the church. The only sort of, the way I got out of that situation where I was stuck in the house is, I started to meet with someone who used to go to that church called Mike, and he was, like, the youth leader, and he was my youth worker back when the abuse was happening. Obviously, I had no idea it was happening, but he was someone that was a bit of, like, a beacon of light to me at the time. He used to have a group called Tower Gang. We'd all go there, and it was just, like, a space where I could forget about everything and just have fun there. I started meeting up with him, and I told him what had happened. And then, like, since then, he just supported me all the way through. He helped me apply to college again. Yeah, he just helped me, like, turn everything around.
But you've mentioned, like, survivor throughout this. I don't think that quite describes you enough. I feel like there needs to be a word that's like, because I think, especially, again, like, going through what you did and then to now be in a position to share it so openly and honestly and in the way that you do is genuinely inspiring. But to now, is it Mike that you've now founded this new program with you're now kind of helping others in that situation?
So the first step I took with this sort of mission, I guess, of wanting to work with survivors and, I guess, like, improve the life of survivors was to do the page. So the first thing I ever did is I uploaded just a podcast to the Instagram page, The Edge of the Bed. And I called it that at the time because it was filmed on the edge of my bed. So I just filmed it there, and I just told my whole story out, and then I posted it. And like at the for like ages, it was just like 20 followers, and people like in the family would share it for me and things like that, which was nice. And then slowly it just began to grow. And then I said to Michael, it'd be great if we could like provide some training to like youth workers like Mike, who then could help. We could use our knowledge of Mike, the youth worker who, I guess, missed the signs, and also bring my perspective of, as a survivor into the training. So we began to sort of work on that, and that's the Be Abuse Aware course. So we're working that in Doncaster, Rotherham and Sheffield, hoping to launch fully this winter. But we've done our sort of trial sessions, and we've got feedback. We've got feedback from the National Safeguarding Team for the whole of Church of England, and they like really liked it. They thought it was really good. We took their like improvements on board and made it even better. So yeah, we're looking to launch it, get it all around all the different youth groups in Doncaster, Rotherham and Sheffield, and then hopefully even further. Yeah, so it's exciting stuff. And then we've
How does it feel now to be in this position?
It's really good. Yeah, I'm excited for it. And with the prevention pathway side, so I've been doing teacher training. So at the end of May, I'll be a qualified teacher. So I've done that because I want to provide a side to the organisation or charity, or whatever it turns out to be, where we go out and provide educational support to children who have experienced trauma. Because I've noticed a bit of a gap throughout my teacher training, also my time in school on my undergrad degree, where children who have been through trauma or, you know, adverse child experiences, they're offered pastoral support, but they're not pushed educationally or pushed in life to achieve higher.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of gap I want to fill. I want to come into schools and give them a little like nice space where they can feel comfortable and be pushed and supported educationally as well as pastorally. So that's the aim with that. So,
wow.
Yeah, exciting stuff happening.
Very exciting stuff, mate. So you're now back home, kind of like you've been through a bit of a turmoil now from like a mental health side of things, like you're starving yourself, you're in hospital. Like, what was going on at that time?
Yeah, so I think I was just unhealthily sort of trying to navigate the emotions that were going on. And, you know, as the investigation went on, I kept having visits from the police, and I had a victim liaison officer, and I did counselling. I didn't really find it that helpful. I felt that I'd come to counselling and she'd expect me to say something, and we'd kind of be sat there and I'd be like, just telling her about my day. I'd be like, oh, so I went to college and I did this and this happened. And like, I had it for a long time. I think I had it for nearly a year, counselling. And every time I felt like I had to bring something for her, like I say, like it was such a strange feeling. So I ended up just not doing it anymore. Started exercising and things like that and trying to get my head in a better space. But yeah, the investigation continued, and I heard stories from people of what he was doing, and he was sort of like becoming like more of, he was an alcoholic already, but he was becoming more of an alcoholic. And he went on holiday to Thailand. So as you can imagine, I wonder what he was doing
there.
Yeah. Which is, you know, just baffling that the police let him go to Thailand, which is a country notorious for middle-class white men to go and abuse children.
Yeah.
So,
or even to leave the country at all, exactly, considering what he's been investigated for.
Yeah, exactly. So it came towards a point where we knew we was going to court, which is a really hard process for anyone who's been for abuse, as they'll know. Like the CPS has to feel like they can charge him, and the police side have to feel like they can sort of win the case. And so yeah, he got allowed to court, and he would have received a letter that had all the charges, and they charged him for like quite extreme charges. They were trying to get him down for quite a long time. And then I remember the week after they told me that they'd sent the letter out, I was in Meadowhall actually, and I got a phone call from the police officer, and she was like, I need to speak with you urgently. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll come home. So I drove home, and then I sat in the living room waiting, and then I saw him pull up, and it was like, I basically had two police officers because one of them left halfway through. But Adam, he was the first one I ever spoke to about my story back on that day when I went to the police station and did that 4-hour interview. And he came with the new police officer, who was called Joe. So I thought, that's a bit strange. Like something big must have happened here. And they came in, they sat down, they was like, we have some like kind of hard news for you. Andrew, obviously your stepdad, he's committed suicide. And I was just like, what? And it just felt so, like, it was such a strange moment. It felt like a dream, like, kind of moment.
Well, as it would, if anyone had just been told that news, it's going to completely devastate you.
Yeah.
But considering what the relationship was and kind of how it almost ended. Mm. Like,
and it was such a pressure to know how to show people how I respond. Like, I felt like a pressure to be like, oh, good. Yeah. Oh, like, good, glad he's gone. But inside,
do people now expect you to be like that?
I think people who know, who follow the page and are survivors, they understand. But people who don't know me and aren't survivors on the page, I get a lot of like negative comments about that, and quite like, some of them are like, are you glad you killed himself? And then other ones are like, how can you be sad that he killed himself? But within my family, it's kind of, I did feel a bit of a pressure to seem not bothered by it. Yeah. And because like certain members of the family were like, oh, I'm so glad that he's gone. He can't hurt anyone else. You've got to think it's a good thing that he like can't hurt anyone else. That's what people would say to me. And I'd be like, yeah, yeah. But then also like, there's them emotions that I described earlier, like he was my dad.
Yeah.
For those years.
Well, there's still an element of loss there. Yeah, there's still like grief. A grieving.
There was definitely. And I think still now it's still a bit of a process where it's like, and then you feel guilty for grieving. Like even now, like if I do have moments where I think back to my childhood, it's like I have to block myself from thinking about childhood memories, even ones that were good and they were enjoyable and happy. And it's like I have to block that out of my mind because I feel guilty for it being a happy memory despite what had happened. Yeah. And then the grief side of it comes in. I feel guilty for grieving because of what he did. So it's such a complex like thing to navigate in my own head, but it's something that I feel I'm processing, and that's what's important. I went through a phase of blocking everything out and just sort of lying to myself that it didn't bother me and that I wasn't grieving for him. And then now it's sort of like the last 2 years, I would say, or year, I'm sort of slowly accepting and feeling comfortable with the fact that all of those things happened. I did grieve for him and I still am grieving for him, but I'm also grieving for the child and the things that had happened and all of those things. So I always say like the most important part of healing from trauma, childhood trauma specifically, is acceptance, because it's so easy to throw it away. And it's all subconscious. You don't realize you're doing it. But it's so easy to throw away those emotions and just ignore them and live past it. So I think, yeah, just accepting it over these last few years, it's been painful, but it's something I can feel that is good for me.
Yeah. How do you, because we talk a lot on the show about like the mental health side of things, and quite a lot of my coping mechanisms has come from having conversations like this, to, because the normal stuff wasn't working for me. Like, I mean, the NHS is obviously phenomenal at what they do, but their advice and stuff when it came to mental health, it didn't work. It wasn't until I was having conversations that I was like, oh, yeah, well, I'll give that a go.
Yeah.
When these kind of emotions of like the grief or like the mental health side of things kind of creeps in, how do you navigate that? Do you have any coping mechanisms that you lean towards on those days?
For me, that's helped the most, I think, is like, it sounds so like cliche, but exercise has been massive for me. In my case, being a male who's been through sexual abuse as well, I haven't been for a long time, but jiu-jitsu I found was such a like healing part of mine. It's a martial art, basically, a grappling martial art. And like it got me comfortable with contact with men and also made me feel more confident within myself. And also any exercise just makes you feel good anyway. Yeah. So exercise has been like the biggest coping mechanism for myself. The page is also probably the second biggest, like just talking to other survivors, connecting with them, just getting my voice out there and kind of knowing that it's for good. It feels as though, I think when you've had an experience like this, it's hard for it not to feel like such a waste of your childhood and things like that. But at least I know by doing this work, something positive is coming out of it. And that's what I kind of value and keeps me going as well.
I think it's incredible. And to be fair, the page, obviously I will link everything into this, like, it's inspiring.
I
like what I like about it, like, so much, it kind of really sets it apart from quite a lot of pages out there. Like, you're not trying to be anything, you're sharing like these really raw kind of moments in your life, but the way that you do it, and like you almost understand why it happened, and you're sharing that kind of side of it, like it's phenomenal.
It really is.
From that side of things, obviously, one of the questions that I wrote down to kind of ask you was around the the label of survivor. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of kind of almost stigma, would you say, with this kind of like the victim, the survivor kind of like label. Yeah. How do you feel about it? Or you're a proud, like, yeah, I did survive it.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm on that side. I think survivor is the term that I prefer. I think victim, like, it's quite strange because whenever I share my story to, you know, some podcasts I've been on or even to people, like new friends that I meet or whatever, and I share my story to them, they almost think that they need to be this like carer and supporting figure, and you're the victim and you need some help of some sort. And like, if any professional setting, if your manager finds out about this thing, which obviously has happened where my manager's seen my page, and they kind of like, do you need any support from us? Do you need any help from us? And it's like, I think I'm all right, you know, I think I'll be all right. I think we need to switch the culture around survivors where it's kind of like, stop talking to them like they're a victim and they need help. Like, they've probably been through more than you, so I think they're going to be fine. When that support is needed, let the professionals do with it. Like, signpost them to professionals if that's something you feel you need to do, if you can see that they're struggling. But if they're coming to you with a conversation and saying, listen, this happened to me, then don't be like, oh, do you need it? Like I say, yeah. It's just that
champion
kind of thing.
It. Champion, yeah, exactly. Like the bravery that they're sharing with you. And like you said, signpost them to where they need to be.
And I think like one of the most comments I get, and I appreciate all the comments on my post, it obviously helps get the word out and reach more survivors. But the biggest one I get is like, I'm so sorry this happened. And like, kind of like they focus on the devastation part of the story. Yeah. Like kind of like, oh, this ruined your life. How dare he? And it's kind of, I want to push the message that I don't like, I appreciate the comments, but I don't want that reaction. Yeah. I want people to say, oh, look, and he's still all right. Look, he's still making it. And I want survivors that see the post to think that, like, I'm not sharing it because I want you to feel sorry for me or to like send a message to me or give me some help, because I don't need that. I can access that if I need. But what I want you to do, like I say, is just look at it and say, oh, look, he keeps going. Maybe with my problems, if they're not a survivor, I can see that. Well, I can keep going and I can keep pushing. So that's the kind of swap I'm trying to, like, integrate into the page.
And to be honest, mate, I think that perfectly answered the question. Like, you are, that's the definition of a survivor. And it's that kind of thing, and I say it a lot on the show, and obviously this is a very different angle to like the normal conversation that I have on here. However, for anyone who is listening to this, like, obviously if you can relate to everything that kind of like Ryan is kind of like speaking about, like, obviously reach out. There is a lot of support out there, but the most important thing is to not give up.
Yeah.
Like, you know, from a mental health side of things, like the conversations like this, I've kind of realized that the shit will happen regardless of who you are, where you are in the world.
Yeah.
But the important bit is that you keep going.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have to kind of define you, and it's like, it does get better.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I try to be as open as I can about the current issues that I face within my healing. Like, although, you know, I don't want to come across as the victim and kind of like I'm struggling, we are still struggling, but we can do it and we can push through. And, you know, I speak a lot about sort of the mental health side that I struggle with. So I struggle with PTSD, depression, and dissociative depersonalization, derealization disorder, which a lot of people don't know what that is. So it's kind of the feeling, like physical feeling, that you're out of body. And it's like you're watching over yourself, like you're kind of like not in control of yourself, but you are. It sounds really like confusing.
No, but it's...
But it's something that a lot of people struggle with, especially survivors. And where it comes from, like, psychologically, is that when you are abused as a child, your brain creates ways to protect itself. So they don't know for sure what causes it, but this is sort of theories around why people experience depersonalization. It's kind of your body comes up with a way to make you feel like it's not happening to you. So that's the sort of maybe the origin of why I experience it. So it can kind of, it links with your emotions as well as your like conscious experience. So sometimes I can be sat somewhere and it's like, it, like something clicks and then it's like, whoa, I feel like I'm in a dream and I feel like well out of it. And like, I can see my hands move and it's like, I'm not doing it. And then also emotionally within relationships, it can make me like not feel close to people as like, I guess a normal person should, because the emotions are dissociated. And I think that's another way of the brain protecting itself from like, oh, don't, because with the complex relationships that I've experienced, I think my brain kind of thinks that relationships can be quite damaging to me, so try to protect me from them. So
it's
yeah,
always that's like, just it's a, like a habit though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's obviously you only kind of know what you know. So yeah, it makes sense in that respect.
Yeah, yeah.
When that kind of creeps in, how do you kind of almost bring yourself back? Is it like a day thing, like week? What does that look like?
So sometimes I can have it for months, like actual months of where I feel like I'm in a dream and I feel emotionally detached. And in those moments, it's kind of like, and I think in my head, like, I know eventually I'll feel all right. But in the moments where it's like, it can get quite bad in like just a split moment and then pass. In those moments, I just kind of like take a minute to be like, it's not going to harm me. The feeling's not going to harm me. Just try and focus. And that's the kind of thing. I think at first, when I first got it, it was like, what is wrong with me? Like, I must have something wrong with my brain. But obviously, as I've went and seen doctors and things, it's kind of like, no, this is just your body's response to the trauma. So
I think this is probably one up there with one of the most like powerful, insightful conversations I've genuinely ever had on this podcast.
I'm glad to hear, yeah, yeah.
There's three final questions that I ask each and every one of my guests, and I wasn't going to ask them today, but the fact that you've drove here from a 1935 gig,
yes.
Like I feel like I'm going to have to ask these questions now. So music for me is one of my biggest coping mechanisms. Yeah. Like the good, the bad, the ugly, that music has always been there to soundtrack it or it just to get me through it.
Yeah.
If there's a song playing, what is it to get you on the dance floor?
To get me on the dance floor. It's going to be a 1975 song. Happiness 1975.
Okay.
That's such a good song.
There's a nice little nod to the corner there.
It's a mean song. And he played it and I was like, proper turn up for that.
But this is what I love about live music. It takes you like completely away or like it reminds you of those kind of moments and you just kind of, you just like, I don't know, in just this real nice state of almost like euphoria.
Yeah. The power music has is just mental and it's something that I've found like healing, definitely.
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, this is going to be a deep one now. I'm a big believer in people having like a soundtrack to their life, mm-hmm. whether it's a song, an album, or even an artist. Is there a song, album, artist that has soundtracked your journey so far?
It sounds strange. It's not the lyrics or anything like that. It's just the song. So Tracy Chapman, Fast Car, that song has been like, so I've got a little side story to this, and this like always gets me when I speak about this. But so before I met Andrew, when my dad left, he left for another woman. She was called Jackie. Okay. And then after those split up, Jackie and my mum became best friends. So an odd friendship.
Wow.
But she like became our auntie Jackie, which is like a common thing in Yorkshire where like your mum's best mate becomes your auntie.
We all have a cousin isn't our cousin.
Auntie Jackie. And so like she did everything for us. Like she basically became our dad. Rather than staying at our dad's, we could stay at Jackie's house on a weekend. And like she got us Christmas presents. And I remember once you remember when people were doing them patterned haircuts with the little, I really wanted that in
did
school.
You have one in the eyebrow?
I didn't. I never had that.
No, nor me.
And so I was like really wanted that. And my mum could never afford it. My mum used to cut my hair. She used to give me like just bald. She's just gone bald.
I'll take that. I used to have a bowl.
A bowl?
I used to have a bowl put on my head and cut around it.
That's brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, take what you can get.
It's true. So she took me to a barber and I got the lines in my hair. So she like just did things like that. It was really nice to us. But she also like helped me with my fear of water. So obviously this was before Andrew. She would teach me that in the bath to talk to my imaginary friend called Jack in the ceiling. And so I could tell him all my problems and my worries and things like that. So then jumping forward to when the abuse would happen, as a distraction from the sexual abuse, I would go back to talking to Jack in the ceiling and I would talk to him about my problems throughout the day instead of focusing what was like actually happening. Yeah. So like I always credit her for like saving me. I think that I think she was looking down on me that whole time and sort of like helping me get through those moments. And she she passed when I was, I think, about 13. So, but her favourite song was Fast Car by Tracy Chapman. So we used to dance in the kitchen and that with her to that song. And so I always listened to it.
this might be quite timely, but there was a Grammy performance recently by Luke Combs.
I was going to say, and Luke Combs is one of my favourite singers. So when that happened, I was like, you showed me it, and I was lying in tears. All like,
I've asked that question so many, I've still got like goosebumps. I've asked that question so many times, and that has been the most perfect response to that question. Yeah. Like, thank you for sharing that.
And that is such a good cover, Luke Combs with Tracy Chapman live.
Beautiful. Hello. Beautiful.
I can't stop watching it. I just go on TikTok to the clip and just listen to it.
Is there a song that you would like to put in a box, wrap a chain around it, kick it to the bottom of the ocean, never hear it again?
That's a tough one.
I mean, no beef. Like, it could be for a number of reasons. It could be just it's overplayed. You hate it.
I think that Happy song by Pharrell, is it Pharrell Williams or whatever it is? That is an awful, awful song. That is so bad.
So you should say that. He's here tonight.
he is.
In the middle of commentary.
That is just such a, like, I mean, his intention were great. It came with positive vibes, but it's just...
But yeah, the happiness turned to sickness quite quickly. Yeah. Mate, genuinely, hand on heart, I respect you like so much. You genuinely probably one of the most inspiring people I've had on this podcast.
I appreciate you saying
that. I appreciate, obviously, you coming from London, like driving down to obviously be here. And I can't wait to see what's next. I will link everything in to obviously, so if you want to find out more about the program, what's it called again?
So it's Prevention Pathways, and the Be Abuse Aware course is the training course, a part of Prevention Pathways.
Amazing. And yeah, like I said, I'll link everything in, but thank you so much for joining me for a waffle.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the Waffle Shop podcast with me, Taylor James. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and even leave a review. It means the world to me. See you soon.